Innovation, disruption, and big issues. This is Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. After I did the Haiti stuff, I just got knocked on my butt. I haven't been sick in over 5 years. I've been working on my immunities, and I got sick. I got a cold. And I think that what it did is it really got to me. And, you know, I'm dealing with a ton of difficult subjects and things. And so it was kind of surprising that that would get to me. But the difference, I think, was that Ezeli Danto was so close to the situation and the emotion and the passion. And it really got me feeling what she is going through and what the people are going through. And I think that's what really got to me. So what I decided to do is bring on an expert that helps with raising your melting point, helping you deal with difficult situations and getting past that. He is Christian Marcoli, and he is Roger Federer's mental coach. Roger Federer, of course, is one of the top tennis, male tennis athletes in history. He's won the Wimbledon, I believe, 8 times. And he is just calm under pressure, and he's notoriously calm under pressure. So I wanted to bring on top expert to talk about this. Everybody's dealing with this difficult news all over the place, and you're dealing with it at work, at home. And I think this getting some tips from someone like him can help all of us. It's not a full hour show, so what I'm going to do after that show is I'm going to bring back part of the interview that I did with Ezeli Danto from Haiti and share with you how powerful that show was. There's actually 4 episodes that I did with her. You can get to all of them at sarahwestall.com. Highly recommend you listen to them. You know, the stuff that's going on in Haiti is going on elsewhere around the world. It's not unique to there. But because it's so close to us and we have people here on the ground who has experience, we can get a good idea of what's actually going on in some of these other countries. So let's get into our interview now with Christian Marcoli.
Hi, Christian. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Hi, Sarah. Nice to be here.
Well, I am really happy you decided to join us because I got to tell you, I kind of got knocked on my butt lately doing this Haiti show. It was a two-part series. And the stuff that I'm learning, and, you know, I do a lot of hard shows, and my listeners are used to hearing a lot of, you know, truth. I do truth in all sorts of different areas, and I bring the best people in the world to talk to. And sometimes the truth can be very difficult to handle. And, you know, from my standpoint, this Haiti thing kind of knocked me on my butt. I haven't been sick in over 5 years. I really work on my immunities. And I got sick after dealing with this one. I got a cold and things, and I know it has to do with just it really got to me. And so I think working, you know, bringing someone like you on, who's an expert, you work with top athletes, famous executives, helping them deal with that melting point. So to start off, can you talk about what a melting point is?
Well, what I call the melting point is that threshold where you feel that things may be getting too much. This could be, you know, too much either to do or it's too much to take emotionally, a little bit what you were describing. And what happens there is that moment and that point where we kind of start to lose our control. And it's then going to be affected on our emotions, on our thinking, going to be affected in our behaviors, and we start to really think and behave in a way which is not productive anymore to the same degree as we would be able to deliver or to perform our best really when we would not hit the melting point.
Well, and I think I want to tie this to current events and to other, you know, listeners who are hearing some of these things that I'm covering. I consider myself a very strong person, and I usually can persevere through a lot, right? So for me, getting sick was like, oh, okay, I need to take a step back. I need to, you know, I started yoga. I did some things. But
good.
But you know, it's the same going all over. You're listening to some, the truth can be really hard. And making change and dealing with the things that we need to deal with in order to make the world a better place can be very hard. And I have a lot of leaders that listen, and I have a lot of people that want to help and make a difference. And it can be very difficult. So I think, you know, helping us understand how we can manage some of these pressures. You talk about, you know, the pressures from the outside world. How can the pressures from the outside world and the general environment really affect your melting point?
Well, you know, it's a difficult time these days, I find, for a lot of people. As you say, lots of change, lots of orientation. You know, we need to find out what's right and wrong. It's not as clear as it used to be. Lots of ambiguity that we need to deal with. And from that perspective alone, it's a period with a lot of instability, and that puts a lot of stress, emotional stress, be it on leaders or being on everybody who has to, you know, to do a good job and to deliver what they're supposed to be delivering. And from that perspective, it's not only about, you know, managing the day-to-day jobs or the tasks that you have to do. It's all based under a certain instability or a certain uncertainty. And we've done research with, you know, even the top CEOs. And these times, Sarah, are the most unstable and the most insecure times that people experience. So leading and making a positive impact on people in under these circumstances is one of the hardest thing for those people.
Well, because people are going through so much, so there's a lot of irrational behavior that they're trying to deal with. So they're trying to keep themselves to be a leader while dealing with a lot of irrational and things around them. It's really hard to maintain that composure and that leadership that you really need, even in your own family and everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. And that's something I'm really also focusing on with, you know, and this is why I wrote this book. It's, you know, performance doesn't really stop at your, you know, workplace or your performance place. It's, to me, performance is a holistic concept. If you're a leader, you're leading at work, you're leading outside of work, you're leading families, you're leading communities. And this has now become so demanding that a lot of people, you know, that come to me and start to work with me really need to learn to manage their energy systematically, because that's such a key thing. You know, it's long days, hard days, lots of open questions. And so much is not in our control. You know, it's like you can't say, okay, let me have a lot of energy in the morning, let me tackle the most important questions, and then in the afternoon I go on with the easier stuff. Who knows what comes in, you know, at 7 o'clock after a long day at work, maybe the hardest question, the most important question you need to answer at that point. So I really recommend everyone out there to be caring about themselves in a way that they stay healthy, that they have enough energy at the end of a long working day. I always tell my people that I work with, you need to have 30% energy left when you leave work, so you can make an impact with the people outside of work. And that, Sarah, needs systematic and strategic self-management through, you know, through the course of the day.
Well, it's like my daughter, you know, after having a really hard day, you know, I'm doing that Haiti thing. And my daughter has a complete meltdown at night. You know, she's a teenager. It's part of being a teenager. And so now I have to manage. She doesn't have the emotional ability to handle everything around her. And she's going, you know what it's like being in high school. Oh, my God. Mm. So my daughter's having this complete meltdown, and I have to be a good parent, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So you got up at night and you spent some time with her, right?
Yeah. I mean, I talk to her and I work through that stuff. I can't just shut her down and say, I got my own crap to deal with, which is what you know, you want to do, but you can, you know, you have responsibilities that's beyond what it is that your job or whatever else that you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is exactly something that, you know, it's always been important, but now, Sarah, it's probably one of the most important concepts that I've been using is if you can go through a normal day, which is not extraordinary busy. I mean, we always have those degrees, right? Is it a good busy day or is it like a super busy day? If you have a normal busy day, I highly recommend that you go through that day with 90% of your energy and you don't give everything, so that you have, you know, a little bit of energy left in general for things like that. I mean, your most important meeting was with your daughter, to be honest. I can imagine that,
yes,
that day,
yes.
Right? But who was, you know, like, you were not able to plan that, right? Because you had no idea how she would respond to all this. So if you would be completely, you know, exhausted and empty and had no energy left, who knows how this conversation with your daughter would have turned out.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's where abuse comes in too, right? Where you got to watch yourself. I mean, I think I did a pretty good job, but I could see people losing it and not being the person they want to be. And whether it's with your daughter or with that your neighbor or with anything that's important to you, you mess it up, right? And what kind of consequences have you seen when people just, they mess it up?
Well, you know, it's a very interesting observation, because people remember us, right? They all remember us. And the funny thing is, they remember us not for the 95% of the time where we were at our best and when we were good. They remember us for the 5% where we misbehaved, or where we had emotional outbursts, or where we said something we shouldn't say. And these things in the brain of the people stick much longer than the others. So I have a concept that I call excellence, and excellence means you really should not allow yourself to show a bad side. And oftentimes people, you know, at work, they kind of have that energy or that intention to still kind of control, and then they're so exhausted and they come home and then they kind of don't have that kind of same attitude anymore, and then they kind of, it's much, you know, outbursts are much likely more to get than at work. So it's something that really needs a holistic mindset of I'm a human being and I'm going to make a difference in the world, and it doesn't really matter if I am doing this at work or at home or in my community or wherever I am. Every minute I'm up, I'm going to make a positive impact. I think that's a mindset we should all take over.
Well, what kinds of things? Let's say you're watching a news show or you're doing something and it triggers you. You know, how do you reach a higher level of knowledge? So how do you go about doing that? So you can, well, let's go back to, you have three factors that interact to determine an individual's melting point. Let's start with some of those basics. What are they?
Well, the first one is your basic psychological, I call it psychological constitution, right? Some of us just have a thicker skin than others. Some of us can take more than others before they melt. I mean, that's, you know, probably grown over the years. That's who they are from a personality perspective. And we need to accept that. And I find we need to be very aware and clear of where we stand. So can I take a lot, or, you know, do I get nervous or anxious easily? That's the first thing. The second thing is what's happening currently in the outside world. Like, what kind of pressures are out there that really are hard for me to take? This could be really only one thing, but it's so hard for me that it has a strong, you know, a heavy impact around the way I think and feel. And the third one is, In the role that I have, you know, there are certain constant pressures that have I grown into that role. You know, leaders, for example, per definition, need to have a stronger, stronger back than non-leaders, because they need to protect other people from certain stresses. So this combination really works into how high my melting point is.
Well, what are some of the main pressures points that raise the heat, as you call it, that cause a person a meltdown?
Yeah, well, it's really, first of all, this is a very individual thing. And as I said, one thing could already cause a meltdown, depending on how painful it is, really, right? So we're talking about things like health issues, family crisis. We're talking about people losing or are in prospect of maybe losing their jobs. It could have a huge impact on their melting point. And there are less dramatic things I find a lot when I work with, you know, leaders and performers, but they're still working very heavily on them. For example, fatigue, politics at work, office politics, you know, toxic relationships. And one, you know, very common thing is now technology, which, you know, basically gives people the opportunity to potentially work 24 hours, 7 days. And especially when you have like driven people who want to make a positive mm-hmm. impact on the world quickly, it's hard for them to disconnect.
Yeah, well, that's me. I could work around the clock. That's why I'm starting to figure out how to back off a little bit. But, you know, isn't there sometimes a low level stress that's always there? And like, for example, you might be losing your job, or, you know, always have a fear of losing your job, or always have a fear if you're working. Like a lot of doctors I know really have an issue with this to the point where they become physically ill because of the stress of people dying mm-hmm. around them or not being able to control their environment. How do you deal with that and not, you know, raise your melting point and be healthy about it?
Yeah. One important thing is that we all regularly disconnect. I mean, I'm so persistent on this fact, on this factor. We all need to disconnect. Whatever you do or whatever it is, you need, you know, preferably in the evening when you're done with work, you need about 90 minutes where you completely disconnect from that thing that's really heavy. And one thing that, you know, most people don't do well is they don't handle devices well. They don't handle, you know, smartphones well. They don't handle tablets well, computers, TV, you know. They're kind of not at work, but they're still connected somehow. They still carry their phones with them.
Yes.
They're checking emails regularly. So, you know, they're saying, yeah, I'm not at work anymore, but actually there's still somehow at work, you know. And that, if you take this is not for one day, Sarah. This is a week or months. If there is no regular disconnect, I almost give you the guarantee that you will reach your melting point earlier.
Well, you know, I actually saw this report where kids that are on devices all the time, that their brain development
yeah.
is actually retarded. And what they did is they brought them out into the desert with nothing, completely disconnected them, and their brain development started to come back.
Yeah, and these are things. I mean, we as you know, parents now, you know, with the kids growing up, this is a new thing. Like we didn't have that, right? And we need to kind of stay connected with what's going on, because otherwise, if that takes over and it's too much, it can really do damage.
Well, yeah, I mean, especially with kids where it's actually affecting their brain development.
Right.
And we just are starting to understand what this is doing to us and to human beings. And I know for myself, just disconnecting, doing yoga or something makes a huge difference. Well,
yeah.
What are some of the things that you do to help people raise their melting point? You know, we talked about
yeah.
disconnecting. What other things can you do to train yourself to raise your melting point so you're productive and healthy?
Yeah. Let me give you another example for disconnecting.
Okay.
A lot of people that I work with, I ask them, where is your mobile phone when you're in bed, when you sleep at night, right? And you cannot imagine how many people tell me it's with me on the bedside table. Right. And I ask them why. And they say, well, I have my alarm clock on it. Right. And then we looked at, you know, specifically looked at sleeping patterns. And we found that people who take their iPhone or their, you know, smartphones close to their bed, what they do before they fall asleep is check in emails. right? And there's almost like this automatic impulse for this email button, and they're checking emails, and that raises anxiety. Plus, you have the blue light from the device that has an impact on the melatonin production, which makes it harder for you to fall asleep. Mm-hmm. So you fall asleep, but you don't sleep well. So the probability you wake up in the middle of the night is higher. So what happens is we found out, we looked at the patterns. What happens is they looked at their iPhone, what time it is. And if they couldn't fall back asleep within 5 minutes, guess what? They were checking emails in the middle of the night, raising their anxiety. They had blue light again. So we found patterns that when they woke up in the morning, they were tired. But no wonder they were tired, right? There was not a moment of restful, peaceful sleep. And it's because of their habits, how they deal with their devices. So my recommendation to all the people out there, put all your devices outside of your bedroom in order to not fall into the temptation to do that kind of stuff.
Yeah, because it's too easy to do that. I try to do that. My daughter doesn't, though, and I got to work with her on that. I'm a bad parent for letting her have her phone in her room.
Well, put the camera up and see what she does in the middle of the night.
Exactly. It's hard with a teenager, but okay. So no, some of these things that you do to raise your melting point, to have more patience and to be able to withstand more. How do you withstand more without causing long-term negative effects? I mean, just being able to take on more isn't necessarily a positive thing.
No, absolutely not. And this is a big danger nowadays because there is so much information available, and it really requires a clear and sharp mind to determine what's the really, really important thing and have the courage to focus on that. It has a lot to do with emotional intelligence. It has to do with, being sharp and being, awake to be able to do that well. It's so easy to not be 100% and start to do everything a little bit instead of focusing on the things you know you're going to make a difference. And with that, Sarah, you make a decision for maybe not doing certain things. That to me is part of leadership. Independently if you're in a leadership role, but taking the courage to say, okay, here's what really matters. Here is what makes a difference. And I'm going to focus on that and do a great job in it. And some other stuff may still be somehow important, but not to the same degree. I can't focus on right now. And with that, if you do that on a regular basis, you get a really good confidence and a really good feeling that you're making progress on the real important things, which is one of the key things in order to raise your melting point, that you have the feeling that you're making progress on the right stuff.
Yeah, because if you don't feel like you're making a difference, then that actually turns up the heat, right?
Yeah, it's nothing more frustrating than spending, 8, 10, 12, 14 hours at work. And at the end of the day, when you go home and someone asks you, how was your day? You say, well, I didn't have a good day because I don't even remember what impact I had. So there's nothing more frustrating than that. But it takes a moment. I call it focus time that you need to embed into your days. So what is focus time? My recommendation is that people at least twice a day take a 45-minute time period where they completely detach from email, phone, and determine what is the most important thing I need to make progress on today, and then invest 45 minutes without interruption and distractors to make progress. If you have two of those cycles, like if you have 90 minutes net time working on something that's really important, most of the people out there will make progress. And there is research out there that looks at satisfaction and when do people call a day, a good day, when they come home after work, and people ask you, did you have a good day? There is research out there that clearly states one of the major factors in order for you to feel that you have a good day is that you made progress on something which matters. So we need to create our behaviors and a structure in a way that we allow ourselves to make progress in order to get that, you know, that feeling at the end of the day that we all deserve.
Well, you have worked with a lot of famous people, athletes, executives, all sorts of leaders in the communities and governments and things. Who have you worked with in the past and maybe now? And can you share with us some, I know you can't, things are confidential, but can you share with us some specific stories that are interesting?
Well, a lot of the work I do is really one-on-one, and it is, as you stated, confidential. I can, you know, one thing that is public and where, you know, people all over the world are kind of very amazed of you know, how he does things is Roger Federer, the tennis star, right? I worked with him many years back already, and specifically around increasing the ability to, you know, stay strong and focused and composed under massive stress and pressure, which, you know, in high level tennis, you have that you're out on the court, millions are watching on TV. And now with him winning Wimbledon and, you know, as the 90th Grand Slam title, I mean, this has been, you know, for so many people in the world, you know, a proof and an inspiration that this kind of concept really works.
Well, he really is. And people talk about that. Pressure, his composure under pressure is pretty amazing. He really is kind of legendary in how he does that. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you, because of hopefully your insights can really help people and listeners. But, and I know everybody's confidential, but can you talk about some of the stories that, you know, some things that might help people?
Well, the thing about having, let me start differently. We all have our inner ambitions and goals and dreams and hopes that we kind of want to achieve in order for us to then look back and say that was a great life, or I had an impact on, I really achieved what I wanted. And that is independent on status, I found. And, you know, it's people sometimes feel that being the president of something is the greatest thing on earth, which, you know, doesn't necessarily need to be. It's what makes a difference for you, and where's the deeper meaning for you, and what kind of, you know, what kind of activity and achievement. So having started with that, for some top performers, this is very clear. You know, I briefly spoke about Roger Federer. For him, being, you know, the greatest tennis player is pretty clear as an objective. For a lot of people out there, though, it's not as clear. You know, what does it mean? What does it mean for you, Sarah? Is it to have the greatest show on earth, or is it something else, right? And I find to develop that clarity of what it really is, right, is, you know, you told me bringing truth to people, right? It's so much more rewarding than thinking of what comes with it, or how many listeners I have, and how big's my audience. You know, it's really how can I make this place, this world a better place by bringing truth to people?
That's my goal, is to bring truth and help people make a positive difference and make the world
a better
place.
And I love that. And I love that, right? And for you, in this case, Sarah, I would highly recommend every morning when you get up, take 5 minutes and visualize and check in with this purpose. Because ultimately, when we're connected with that purpose, it drives automatically our behaviors through the day. But I find a lot of people, because, you know, they're getting up and they're checking emails right away, or they go to the internet, or they're watching news right away. I find a lot of people are not connected with their purpose. And I find there's so much information and influence on us that I really recommend that, you know, people taking a first step in the day by connecting them with their values and their purpose. And really let the day be guided by that. So am I making sense?
Yes, yes, that's great.
So if you have a 5 minute in the morning and you have a 5 minute transition ritual between work and home, which again connects you with maybe a bit of a different purpose, you know, because at home you may have a different ambition or a different meaning. And it needs to tweak the way you connect yourself to what you're going to do now. So, you know, having those 5 minute rituals in the morning and the 5 minute rituals when you transition between work and home, you have a very good, strong mental preparation for the next couple of hours to be at your best.
Well, what other, is this kind of what you tell everybody? Or do you tell people different things based on the problems that they have?
I in the individual coaching process I have, of course, we tailor-made everything and we really go into the specifics of the personal situation. But there are some general principles that I recommend to everybody. As I said, disconnect on a regular basis, check in with your values and purpose on a regular basis. That is independent on personal situations.
Well, how do you work with people in general? Like, do they come to you and then say, "Hey, I got issues. How do I become better? You know, I'm leading this corporation or I'm starting this charity and I really want to help the people in this community because they're being taken advantage of, but I'm struggling with all the pressures or, you know, the politics or whatever. And I want to raise my melting point or I'm, you know, whatever they are that they're dealing with." How do they?
Yeah. That's usually how I get contacted. You know, people have heard of me or have written, read my books, and then they reach out and they say, "Look, I'm fascinated by the work you do. It's something that I feel can help me," and it goes in the direction that you were describing. You know, they feel they really can make a difference. But in the given circumstances they are, they need to learn to better manage their energy. They need to learn to better disconnect. They need to learn to better stay focused in order to do so. And this is not for, you know, oftentimes it's not for a specific day. This is a general increase of the melting point. It's a general learning of a set of skills, which allows me to be at my best on the highest level.
Now, do you ever come in and deal with groups of people? Like, they're all maybe like a high-level military group that's going to go in and do some kind of thing that's really difficult, where you might go in and help out a group of people.
Yeah. Yeah, I do it a lot in the business context. I have many leadership, you know, executive teams where, you know, the way it works usually is the leader starts to do that work individually and then she or he says, you know, "This is great. Can we do this with our team?" Because also teams have melting points. You know, this is when does a team become dysfunctional? You oftentimes can observe a certain amount of pressures that trigger dysfunctionality. And raising that collective melting point is another thing that I do with, especially with corporate teams.
Well, how about with sports teams? That's really interesting. A melting point can be when they fall apart on a field.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in sports, I go as far as saying at the end, when it comes down to a final or who's going to win the decisive match or competition, it's probably 80-90% all about the melting point. And sports is great because we can all watch it, you know, live in the stadium or on TV. We're so close to the athletes doing that. I think that's the fascinating things about sport. We can watch it, and even if we aren't as fit as, you know, the athletes, we can still relate to that. And observing people, you know, athletes or teams win while others lose, ultimately I find in most cases it's about who has a higher melting point.
Yeah, because you can see that people buckle under pressure when they could have just slammed at home and they just can't do it.
Right, exactly.
Well, how can people reach you and get a copy of your book?
Well, the book's out there. You can order it anywhere, right? So that's easy. And anyone who wants to, you know, reach us and work with us or interested for a conversation, feel free to contact me at www.markcoley.com. Yeah, we're doing, you know, our work all over the world. So I travel a lot, and this is long distance coaching. Everything's not a problem.
Thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it. And I have a copy of your book, and I'm going to read it. And I'm not going to stop doing what I'm doing. And it's just going to keep getting harder. And I am okay with that. I just have to come up with some plans.
Exactly. And you're going to find a lot of tips in the book. So I hope it's going to be helpful for you.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. And have a wonderful day.
Thanks, Sarah. You too. Thanks.
So I hope you got some good tips there. You can go to his website at markcoley.com. And I will also have his link up on my website if you want to get more information about him and what he does. But let's get into part of my interview now with Ezeli Danto on the crimes that are going on in Haiti. Well, let's dive deeper now into the crimes in Haiti, starting with organ trafficking. Why is Haiti a prime target for this activity?
Because we're helpless. We don't have a colonial father like the rest of the 15 European, there's 15 Caribbean nations, and each of them are, you know, Jamaica is still a property or a commonwealth of the Queen. Trinidad is still, and plus, you know, the world powers have come to Haiti for a reason. Remember, I know Americans don't understand this because it's so irrational. I didn't understand it either because it's so irrational. And I was taught in school that, you know, educated people were scientific and rational. But there's this hatred for Haiti from France, who we beat in combat, Spain, who we beat in combat, and Britain, who we beat in combat. There's a hatred.
That you're just kind of a sitting duck. I think that not having a nation, a large nation supporting you, you're pretty...
What you have to understand is at work, I think the first time that they started all this stuff, sex trafficking, sex slavery, all of that, it's with the Catholic Church in Haiti, just like it's with the Catholic Church all over Africa. If your audience knows anything about sexual abuse, you know, sorts of scars people forever, especially a child. It takes your innocence away. So this is how you have to look at the Haitian oligarchy. The Haitian oligarchy are these light-skinned children that these priests, a lot of them, are their children. So there's so various levels. So we'll start in 1870, after all this happened and Haiti got its independence, one of our president allowed the Catholic Church to come back as our educators. And so they became our educators. French became our national language. Catholicism became a national. And they brought in the Jesuits. And I think they call them the Le Père, the Holy Ghost Fathers. I think the first school that started was 1865, and it was the Holy Ghost Fathers, and it was Collège Saint-Martial. They have a group of Jesuit priests that call Frères l'Instruction Chrétienne, like the brothers of Christian education. Louis Gonzague is the school that every Haitian dictator, Martelly, went to, okay? These are the schools that educate our various elites. What I have learned because of my work and because these people come to me on the side is that many of these children are abused when they're little by these priests.
When you say little, how little?
Collège Saint-Martial, I think it's like 14 years from from elementary to like an associate's degree it goes. So they do their education at these levels, right? So they go to these schools. These schools are run by these priests, these French priests, these folks, priests. I just told you the three of them, right?
So they start abusing these children when they're in elementary school.
That's right. Okay. That's right. I just to do this interview, I spoke to a very good person today. And he told me, I said, listen, it's been a while since I've had this conversation, and I'm going to have this conversation today. Could you tell me what your experience was at St. Louis Gonzague and the Collège Saint Martial? He says, I have never said this to not even my father. I'm going to tell you, there was a priest who constantly was abusing me when I was a child. And he says, I wasn't the only one. So if any of you have looked at the MK Ultra program where the CIA mind controls folks, one of the ways of mind control is by sexual abuse. So today I have a deeper understanding of the assimilated Negroes in Haiti, the ones that do the coup d'etats, because part of that is sort of like a Stockholm syndrome. Because their parents went to those schools. Those schools are only for certain class of people, not the masses. The masses, they send to these orphanages of Catholic Relief Services orphanages, World Vision, CARE, UNICEF.
And so the elites send their lighter-skinned people to special schools, and they're sexually and physically or sexually abused, and it's like the MK Ultra program. And the masses go to orphanages, and what happens to the masses?
Yeah, the masses go to, now you have to understand that USAID wasn't a factor. Yes, USAID and foreign aid wasn't a factor until the 1970s in Haiti. So that orphanage hoax has only been happening since then, right? But the elites, that's been happening since 1865 when Collège Saint Martial started, right? So these priests, what happens is that, like, let's say Bridgeport Diocese, okay, because I've dealt with them with the Douglas Pilitz case. Let's say, you know, a priest, I'll give you an example because it happened to me. Let's say a priest has been found in Indiana, to have molested children, and they can't move them around anymore. They'll send them to Haiti or Africa, and then what the hell he wants to do.
And then once they're in Haiti, they just let them go? Here you go.
Yeah. Okay, now those are the folks that are doing the orphanages thing, because the Catholic stuff is very hierarchical, right? They tell these Haitian children, males, this is all males, they tell these Haitian males that if you want to be a friar, if you want to be, you know, one of us, you know, and they, you have to deal with this. And so for the longest time until Duvalier, none of the Catholic priests that were trained in Haiti, they were never, the hierarchy of the Catholic was always these white priests. It wasn't until Duvalier came into office that he changed it, and then you have like darker skinned kids allowed to get into school. That's why, you know, so that came in 1957. But before, it was all these, they would not really let, you know, unless you're very powerful black person, it was more the light skinned folks, and no Haitian, no matter what color, was allowed to be a priest in Haiti. But now they have them as part of the priesthood. And of course, you know, I was representing Aristide, and he was a former priest, and I've represented a lot of priests. So I was able to just get inside information about a lot of this stuff. So the Catholic pedophiles, essentially, it's like a code of silence. Because this, to go to St. Louis Gonzague, to go to these schools, it's like going to Harvard. Right? Because if you go to St. Louis Gonzague, right, it's a Jesuit school. It has Jesuit schools, like, you know, it has Columbia. A lot of Haitians have gone to Columbia University coming from these schools. So if you can, and I had this conversation today. They take it because it's a way to get an education. It's a way to move. And then they end up getting married and having children, but that scar is always there. And what you also have to understand about this scar is that it's cyclical. It's generational. What you learn as a child, sometimes you practice on your children. So that's why that whole LGBT thing has a different color for Black people. So another layer is the rape of women by the priest in Haiti. I was told today, one priest, I'm told, in the area of Lekai has at least 74 children scattered around that zone. If you are a poor Haitian person and you can't pay for your child to be baptized, and they tell you, you know, if your child don't get baptized, you're going to go to hell. Then either you sleep with the priest, or there's a place they told me today in the north where one of the priests owns most of that land, because he gets a piece of tract of land in exchange for doing baptism, funerals, and marriages. So Collège Séminaire Saint-Michel is, like I said, is one of those spaces. I did speak to one person who said to me that only one of the priests there tried to molest him, that he had like 10 other teachers and nothing like that ever happened to him. Because I want to make that point, because he said that to me. And they're run by, like I said, the Holy Ghost Fathers. And then you have St. Louis Gonzague. So if they're not the priests that have a fetish for Black boys like this, they're the ones that are doing pedophilia on the children. One of them said to me, his mother one day had brought his sister to a service. And the priest said, don't ever bring her here again, because you know, she might end up getting abused. So that is very critically to understand about the mindset of some of these men in Haiti, because then when the international community comes, they sort of even expect it, that that's what they want from them.
So do people go there as tourists, or men go there from around the world looking for sex with minors? Is it easy to get that set up?
That's right. Yes, it is. My first case was Douglas Prelitz. He was at the Jesuit University of Fairfield University in Connecticut. He had been raping and molesting Haitian children at a project in the north called Project Pierre Toussaint. There was about 300 Haitian boys in that space. The way that Douglas Prelitz got to Haiti will give you a clue as to what's going on with that. He claims when he finally, and I learned about that case in 2005, he wasn't sentenced to, he is now serving a 20-year sentence in Connecticut, in federal prison, for molesting and abusing these boys, nearly 20. So he said essentially that he was brought to Haiti by a delegation of the chaplain from Fairfield University. The chaplain's name is Father Paul Currier. They have in Haiti these things called like parish twining programs, where different parishes twine with different spaces in Haiti, and they have guest houses. All kinds of things happens in these spaces, okay? I can just say my experience. So my experience is with what I learned from the Douglas Prelitz case. The boys, in exchange for giving these boys like food, blankets, and pillows, he required them to do certain acts, and he taught them those acts. If your audience go on any of these internet sites, this guy actually had a fetish for Black children. So in the pleadings that the prosecutor, in the pleadings, the prosecutor listed the sites that they found on his computer, stuff like gay black boys, Caribbean, da 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 da, all kinds of things like that, that you would never, I mean, this stuff is so nasty. It blows my mind. I'm going to have to wash myself after having this conversation. But this is what they do to the most vulnerable people on the planet. I had the honor of representing those boys at Douglas for Libs, and I'm going to put on my website, if I in the next couple of days, the actual statement that I made in court in New Haven when we went after Douglas Prelitz. But what's really important in a connection to the Clintons and other people in this kind of stuff is that there's a picture out there where the Paul Farmer, who was UN deputy envoy to Haiti under Bill Clinton, you know, is giving the thumbs up to Douglas Prelitz, this pedophile. They all stick together. I had no clue that these white people were doing this kind of thing.
Now, could you prove that the Clintons were related to this child trafficking case?
I can't prove that. I can prove that they're associated with Paul Farmer. Bill Clinton was UN envoy to Haiti. Paul Farmer was deputy UN, and he was chosen by Bill Clinton to be his wingman. Also, Hillary Clinton had nominated Paul Farmer as the mission to be the mission director. He didn't make it, and I'm told the reason that he was withdrawn was because of certain things that are in his background. I was told that by some a very knowledgeable intelligence person. What we are told, and I can't prove it, is that there is a hospital that was built in the north by Paul Farmer. He is the head of something called Partners in Health. And everybody kind of lionized this person because he's written these books that makes him very, very, looks like he's very progressive. And he may have started out progressive at a certain point, but he's definitely part of the war party. He's definitely part of the neoliberal party. He's definitely part of the pathology of power in Haiti. He, like I said, he was hanging around with this pedophile. They know more than I did. I didn't know these white men. Okay. I'll tell you what happened to me. When I was representing Haitians who were being killed by the coup d'etat people, this guy who now is the head of, his name is Brian Concannon, who's the head of IJDH, Institute for Justice for Democracy. And on his board is Paul Farmer. Remember I told you Paul Farmer was the deputy UN envoy under Bill Clinton. He's also the guy that owns the big hospital. They built a hospital, not where the earthquake was, but in Hinch, in Mirbalet. That's Paul Farmer's hospital. And there's allegations, you know, I'm not making these allegations, but people like George Webb has says that there is trafficking going on there in terms of organ trafficking. So it's like, but I do know, what I know for sure is the connection between Paul Farmer, Douglas Prelitz, Fairfield University, Brian Concannon, and there's another from, I won't name him because he's in Philadelphia. These lawyers who say that they're representing Haitian interests and they're representing the left, the Lavalas, the Aristide. When I walked into that space, I did not know this stuff was happening, that they were hurting children. And then they would tell me when I said to the Haitian men, for instance, who were activists, I said, this guy is going on a delegation and he's sleeping with little 14 and 15 year old girls because he is paying for their education. Like they, you know, a lot of these activists would go to Haiti and they would sleep with these 14, 18 year old girls while they telling everybody that They're for social justice. You know, how are these little girls going to say no when they need an education? And these activists are doing it. Well, this is the reason why none of them talk to me. And this is the reason my name is like mud. Because I've said, I don't care if you're mammal, mineral, plant, or vegetable. You hurt a child. And I don't care if that child is on the Republican side or Democratic side, la 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 side, whatever. Esli Danto's coming after you. If I can prove it, I'm going to put you in jail. I'm going to put your name out there. So I was at the beginning when I didn't know anything. I was looking at my elders who were here before me, and they were hanging around with all these guys. And I ended up understanding what was going on because one day, one of these lawyers connected to IDGH, I'm not going to mention his name, called me up and said, Ezili, you got, and this is when IDGH didn't have a platform. Today, IDGH is the guy who did the cholera case. They kicked me out of that cholera case because they can get Matt Damon and all these other people to be on their board, right? And so they can take on these big cases and get a lot of money, right? So one day, one of these guys called me. Because I had the Esli Network in 2004 when IDGH did not even have a platform yet. And he said, Esli, there's a white guy in Haiti. His name is Ron Voss. And the Haitian police have put him in jail. And it's because of political purposes, because he wants democracy in Haiti. Could you please, kindly, please send out an urgent action alert? Well, because I thought we were the same people, I believe this guy. That today, I don't believe any white person that come to me in Haiti. You're guilty until I can prove you innocent. Because I had this experience.
Too bad. But I understand, and I think our listeners need to understand. That's why I like to listen and let you speak. They need to understand where you're coming from and what you've gone through of why people are scared of white people. You know, it is what it is, and I can understand it. But keep going.
I'm telling you, so I did not know that Ron Voss was a former police out of India who was a pedophile. And I sent out, because they asked me to, and I believe these guys, I sent out an urgent action alert saying, hey, listen, give this guy due process. I mean, maybe if they had told me, you know, I wouldn't have touched it. I'm so sorry. And to this day, okay, if you put my colonial name and put Ron Voss, you say, they'll tell you, Esli Danto's supporting this pedophile. It's still out there.
And it's so wrong. Okay. They're doing that just to take you down. Now,
I asked those guys to tell people I didn't know anything about this guy. To this, they never did.
Now, can I ask you, the person that you took to court, who was an obvious pedophile that you guys nailed, and he got the full punishment by law, he ended up not going to prison. How did he get off?
No. He did go to prison. Douglas did go to prison. That was that. There is another. There's others that have not gone to prison. That
so he did.
There's
Very
others
good.
That.
Okay.
Oh yeah, he did. Good. He did. But this is the thing. Okay, what I was able to do, and I'll tell you why he went to prison. And this is important. If you go out there, you'll see a picture of, and I want to say their name, Komakota. They're out of Brooklyn. I live in Connecticut, and I have an office in Connecticut as well as New York. And then I have, you know, my projects in Haiti. I try to get to go to the Haitian community, to go to the Haitian Catholic community, to say, please come with me. I'm in court trying to help. To, you know, because obviously, you know, it's the prosecutor that does all the work. But I wanted to stand and say that there are Haitians who care about their children, right? So, and we had run a letter writing campaign to the judge, Judge Arditon, asking her not to give him bail because he has so much money from the Catholic, wealthy Catholics in Fairfield County.
So if you like the material that I'm producing, I hope that you will decide to support me on Patreon. You can go to patreon.com under Sarah Westall. And if you donate, you will get my ebooks for free, my first two for free. And then there's different tiers and things. I just really need your support to pay the basic costs for the service and everyone who supports me, I appreciate so much. You're helping to get these voices heard and so much important information out there. So I want to tell everybody to have a great rest of the week and have a great day.